also the 30th of January 1985 with Anthony Parsons. So we stopped learning, we told you about the unrest at the universities. The Shah said that they were foreign inspired agitators, and you dropped the subject.
And there were many other things, really, as the years went on, where we in the embassy thought that either things were going actively wrong, or the Shah's own initiatives were clearly not working. Which I could, I suppose, have talked to him about. I mean, with a close friend like Amir Abbas Haridar, I mean, I certainly did. I mean, we used to discuss
it. And didn't he pass it on?
I don't believe so, no. I don't believe so. I used to a lesser extent, but to a fair extent, with Asadullah Alam. Whether he passed it on or not, again, I'm not sure. But I always hesitated to do so with the Shah, I mean, really, for two reasons. First of all, as I put in my book, I assumed, with all his intelligence services, that he knew all these things at Amside better than I did, so that I would not be telling him anything he didn't know. Which was, of course, a false assumption. And secondly, because it would have been breaking my rule about, you know, really trying to conduct a perfectly normal relationship between two equal countries. I mean, for example, traveling around the country and just talking to people. It was pretty clear to all of us, outsiders, within a few months, that the Rastakhiz experiment was a fiasco. And it was either being completely ignored or just laughed at.
But I don't understand that, because the Shah, with his respect, and I'm sure it was genuine, for a sort of Western type democracy, could he go for a one-party system which was the hallmark of Eastern Bloc? I mean, did nobody tell him that? What is the point of having a party if it's only one party?
Well, of course, I don't know. See, I just don't know now how much people did tell him. But the decision, you see, came, as far as we, the foreigners, outsiders were concerned, completely out of the blue. I mean, I'd been actually only a few weeks before to, in the diplomatic gallery at the enormous Iran Naveen Congress, which was held somewhere west of Tehran, I can't remember where now. You know, and it all seemed to be going along, and there'd just been elections as far as I can remember, and then suddenly overnight we've read in our papers that, you know, it's all been scrapped and something new has been put in its place. Everything seemed to happen like that. I mean, I remember the share participation decision, you remember, kind of industrial democracy, as it were, and it was just announced one day in the papers. I don't know how much prior consideration or consultation there'd been. I suspect very little. Because my closest confidant, in a way, was Amir Abbas. I mean, we used to talk completely freely because we were such old friends. And I certainly got the impression that some of these major decisions had come as much of a surprise to him as they had to the rest of us.
It seems to me that the poor Shah's intelligence was in order to stop him from knowing what was happening rather than to inform him.
This was, I suppose, where we, the outsiders, you see, did make a fundamental mistake. Because the Shah was always very boastful about this, particularly in the presence of foreign visitors. I used to take dozens of cabinet ministers and members of the royal family, distinguished British people and that kind of thing, up to see him. And he often used to introduce this subject of how, well, his thesis was that he had had a Shah people revolution, which meant, in effect, that he had jumped over the heads of the establishment, as it were, and had created a direct link with the people themselves. In order to sustain that direct link, he, the originator of this philosophy, had to be in close day-to-day touch with everything that was going on in the country. And he was always used to go on to say that I have X number of different independent sources of intelligence, and so I am in a position to put all these together and come to my own conclusion as to what the people are really thinking. Well, I don't say that I swallowed all that, but given the fact that his expertise on the subjects which we used to discuss, foreign affairs, strategic matters, was so great, I rather naturally assumed that he also knew what was happening in his own country, a damn sight better than I did. So that if I did tell him, say that in my experience after, say, a tour around northeast Iran or something, that so far as I could gather that the Rastafis thing had been a complete fiasco and nobody was interested in it, that I wouldn't actually be telling him anything he didn't know. And this, of course, was where we were all wrong. And it wasn't really until, I suppose, 1978, that I started to realize how totally divorced he was from what was happening in his own country.
So now, going back to the 1974, a lot of people have said, and I'm sure you have read about that, when he quadrupled the price of oil at the end of 73, the end of 74, he sort of, in effect, signed his own death warrant insofar as the foreign countries became very angry here and proceeded to destabilize the country systematically. Now, we do know that destabilization can happen. Mm-hmm. We are witnessing it in certain parts of the world at the moment, and we have witnessed since the war done by Russia in various parts of the world. I mean, they do it systematically everywhere. So it can happen, and one of the things that they said that destabilization was not only the internal upheavals, but also foreign press. There's no doubt about it that the foreign press had it in for the Shah. I mean, there was not one day where there wasn't some kind of a knife put into him, whereas nowadays there's absolutely nothing. Nobody's living in the Mark Khomeini. Occasionally there's a caricature or something, but basically people seem to have forgotten about it. So, I mean, how would you refute that?
Well, I mean, I know that this is a very commonly held view, but I don't myself believe that there is an atom of truth in it. I mean, to start with, you see, with the oil price rise, although, I mean, I can only speak for my own government and to some extent for other Western governments too, because we were all conferring very closely at the end of 1973. To start with, although the Shah was the actual, well, was the person, it was the Iranian government, as it were, which actually made the final decision at OPEC to increase the price to $11 or whatever it was, I mean, the actual numerical increase. I think the general view amongst the Western governments, which I would still maintain, is that the trebling of the price was in fact a direct consequence of the October War of 1973 between the Arabs and the Israelis. I mean, if it had not been for that war, I mean, the price was surging upwards because of the oil embargo against the United States and other countries by the Arabs, which led to a shortage, which led to the spot market going through the roof. I mean, oil prices were rising rapidly from October 1973 through. So although it was actually, I mean, Iran actually took the lead at the OPEC meeting in December 1973 to actually raise the price to the point that it reached. I mean, I think the kind of political feeling in the West was that this was really a consequence of the October War. And if you listen to programs now on television or read the papers about that period, you very, very seldom hear or read anybody saying that the Shah raised the price in 73. They all say the Arabs. I mean, it's not all that number of people who realize, actually, that it was actually at that meeting an Iranian initiative. So I don't think that the blame for that, or the resentment of Western governments, was directed so much against the Shah. I think it was regarded as an inevitable consequence of the October War and the use by the Arabs of the oil weapon. Now, by that same token, the Shah, in fact, setting aside the question of price, you see, gained himself enormous popularity at that time in the West by the fact that he refused to use the oil weapon. He was under great pressure from the Arabs to join the embargo against certain Western countries until Israel withdrew or whatever it might have been. But he firmly refused to use the oil weapon for political reasons. So in fact, apart from the price, I mean, the Shah, in Western eyes, came well out of that. So there was certainly no reason in that sense for anybody to want to destabilize the government in Iran. And secondly, there is no question about this. I mean, certainly in Britain, certainly in the United States, France, I mean, anybody else who might have been concerned, we all did regard the Shah's regime as by far the best conceivable government in Iran from the point of view of the general stability of the region and also from the overall point of view of Western interests. I mean, I think we all believe that if the Shah fell, that we didn't, I don't think, anticipate for a moment that he would be replaced by a government of religious clerics. We would have guessed, I think, that he would have been replaced by radical Qaddafi-type officers or radical left-wingers of some kind, which might very well bring in the Soviet Union, which might create an East-West confrontation. No, I mean, the stability of Iran under the Shah, never mind the price rise, was a very important factor for the West. And I don't think there was any question about that. I mean, I don't think, you know, Western governments, even if they had given, put 100% blame on the Shah for the price rise, I mean, they don't really behave like that. I think the reason why there was this enormous commercial drive for Western exports to Iran was twofold. I mean, commercially it was because the contracts were lucrative. And in another sense, I think there was a feeling in the West that since we were now paying three times as much for our oil as we had the day before, we must get as much of that money back as we possibly could in commercial terms. Yes. So, I mean, we really regarded Iran as a very attractive prospect once the price had been put up. And, you know, so long as Iran was stable and doing business with us, the last thing we wanted to do was to disturb that. Mm-hmm. I mean, you've only got to really look at the behavior of the West in the IDLs, I mean, really almost until the end. I mean, all Western leaders were beating a very deep path to Iran. I mean, if we wished to destabilize Iran, I mean, we wouldn't have had just about every single member of our royal family pouring out there, every single member of the cabinet, all the kind of leading members of the British establishment. And then the same was true in France and Germany and the United States and God knows what. No, I mean, I know that most of my Iranian friends believe this, but it really is complete rubbish.
It is. So what about the relationship between the British and clergy? I mean, when you just ceased that, I mean, there had always been the relationship between the British and the Persian clergy. That's another point of contention, that why was it that it wasn't a Qaddafi died colonel who took over, but a Muslim fanatic?
Well, I mean, in the past, of course, there was, no doubt, there was the link between the British and the clergy. I think in what we might call British imperialist philosophy, the reason for this was that whenever the British penetrated another country, whether it was in the full colonial sense like India or in the sphere of influence sense like Iran, the first thing the British always did was to seek out the traditional leaders of society and try and form a relationship with them. So I think it was natural that back, going back to the 19th century and the early 20th century, that the British should have formed a link with the clergy. But I believe myself that and indeed from my own experience, that 1951 to 53 was a watershed in our terms in our relationship with Iran. I'm not for a moment trying to deny that we were messing about in Iran's internal affairs before then, and going right back perhaps to, I don't know, Fatali Shah. But really that was a watershed, that breach. I was actually on the Persian desk for about a year in the Eastern Department, in the Foreign Office, at that time when I came home from Baghdad, through 54. And we really did make a conscious decision, even as late as early as that, that, you know, we must make a fresh start. I can't swear whether, I don't know, Roger Stevens or the earlier ambassadors after that time had any relationship with the Turkey. But I know, as well as I know my own name, that certainly in Dennis Wright's time, in Peter Ramsdorff's time, and in my time, there was absolutely no relationship between the British and the Turkey whatsoever. I never even took
So the Khomeini phenomenon is a sort of sui generis. It's
well, it certainly owed nothing to us. I remember, I think I put this in the book, that in September 1978, the Shah said to me, could I do anything to get the clergy and Gong, not Khomeini, but Chariat Madari and people like that, to cool it down a bit. And I remember losing my temper with him and saying, look, because of your suspicions of us, neither me nor I nor my predecessors for years have even taken the hands of a mullah. We don't even know them by sight, let alone to speak to them. And now you ask me to go and get them to cool it. Well, I mean, it's just nonsense. No, I mean, I still believe to this day, I mean, I know none of my Iranian friends believe me, that there was absolutely no foreign hand, as it were, behind those events. I'm not saying that the behavior of foreign powers didn't influence events. I mean, there's no doubt that Carter's general attitude to human rights, as expressed from Washington, had its impact both on the Shah and on the opposition. The Shah was worried, the opposition took heart. No question about that, but that I don't call, you know, the hidden hand, as it were. It wasn't deliberate because it was a global policy. I mean, he was having the same effect on Latin American countries and people whom he was criticizing. But I believe, I still do, right to this day, that the causes of the revolution were Iranian causes, that it was basically a quarrel between Iranians and Iranians, and that really there was no foreign interference, and indeed, even if there had been, foreigners could have done nothing about it. Even the Soviet Union, and I'm not saying that maybe if somebody came along to the Russian embassy and said, look, can I have $1,000 so that I can set up a printing press and you know, produce anti-Shah pamphlets, if they didn't give it to him, as it were, in a kind of low-level way like that. But I don't believe that they, for example, were trying to destabilize the Shah.
Where did the money come from?
The bazaar. I think so. I very much doubt if there was any outside money. I mean, you know how much money there is in the bazaar. I mean, an infinite amount. And I think it was. I mean, I still believe what I wrote in my book, that essentially it was a symbiotic relationship between the bazaar and the clerical, the religious classes, which formed the kind of basic engine of the revolution. And that the intellectual opposition, as it were, the modern opposition, whether it's radical left, Mujahideen, or National Front, as it were, was simply riding on the top of this engine. But this was the heart of the thing, which is the backbone of Iran. I mean, the artisan class, the bazaar, and the religious class. In fact, really, what had happened was, we outsiders all thought that the Pahlavi revolution had actually transformed the country into something different. And we found out at the end that it had not. It had only scratched the surface. And we were really dealing with the Iran of 1906 or 1892, the actual political configuration of the country had not changed.
And that it was really a counter-revolution rather than...
I believe so, yes. The method was the same, the national strike, all that kind of thing, withdrawal, civil disobedience and so forth. Rioting followed by civil disobedience, exactly the same as happened over the tobacco
revolution. Quite, except that you see in the past, I mean, even during the constitutional revolution, both the clergy were pro-revolution and even those who were against, like Kianuri and so on, they were very intelligent and cultured and enlightened men. The difference is that this seems to be a sort of morbid mutation, a cancerous mutation of what was a genuinely beneficial force in the past in Iran, more or less. Even compared to Kianuri, and I only mention him because Khomeini is supposed to have some regards for him, was a much, much more of a Muslim, let's say, for the point of a better word, than Khomeini is. Khomeini is not a Muslim, he's some kind of a, I don't know, like a sort of Sikh. But he really is. He's some kind of a sort of Sikh devil.
Well, of course, I suppose that you really, that the, I suppose, you know, there's a mathematical thing, isn't there, in physics or something, that each action produces an equal and opposite reaction. I suppose the Shah did ascend the pinnacle of supreme one-man rule, perhaps to a greater extent, as far as the country as a whole is concerned, than anybody had in Iran, I mean, since, say, Shah Abbas. I mean, most Shahs through Qajar times and that kind of thing, and later Safavid times, had shared power, had had to maneuver to balance various elements of power, the bazaar, the religious classes, the intellectuals of the time, etc., etc., the military. So they were more or less rather like medieval kings in England. They were, as it were, part of the power struggle themselves, and they were only reaching supremacy by allying themselves with one group against another group and forming different patterns of alliance. The Shah, because Reza Shah never really had the time, eventually became totally supreme, it seems, over everybody. He didn't have to, as it were, accommodate this group or that group. He was the supreme power. This was really rather a unique phenomenon, I think, in Iran. And I think it's produced an equally violent reaction. A more total collapse, fundamental collapse, than would have been the case if he'd been, say, the Shah of the 1950s, where he was to some extent sharing power with other elements.
So, yes. But, so you couldn't do anything about it, and you don't think that your sort of observations filtered through Hoveda to the Shah?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. I remember... the last time I saw Hoveda face to face as opposed to on the telephone was in, I think, October 78, when he was out of office. But after all, he'd been the Shah's Prime Minister for 13 years. He was alleged to be very close to the Empress. I went to see him in his mother's little house in Shemiran, and we talked for a couple of hours about the crisis. And he had many ideas, you know, as to how the Shah might be able to resolve it. And we talked for a long time. And I said, well, look, Amir Abbas, I take it you're getting all this through to the Shah, all the things you've been saying to me. He said, no, I have no way. I said, can't you do it by the Empress or something? He said, no, I have no way. He said, I know he's seeing you the whole time, Tony. He said, if you can get across some of the things I'm saying, well, please do. But he said, I have no way of doing it. And I don't think he ever really did. I mean, I think he saw the Shah at cabinet meetings and meetings of the Higher Economic Council and all that kind of thing. But I very much doubt, even now, looking back on it, whether he ever kind of sat down alone in the Shah's study, like Asad al-Aram did, and they just kind of chatted for an hour or so. I don't think he ever had that kind of relationship. I may be wrong, but I always got that impression.
So in that case, it would have been better to try and filter things through as a Dalai Lama, no?
Well, to some extent, of course, I used to. And, of course, Asa Dalai Lama did have this relationship. I mean, this is a story not about domestic affairs, but it's an illustration of his influence. And I've not told this story in my book, and I don't think I've ever told it before. And if these go into this archive, someday somebody may come upon this. When he was dying, this must have been in 77, late 77, and he was a dying man. I mean, he was in his house, he wasn't going to the office. He looked like a skeleton. I got a telegram from the Foreign Office one day saying that an Iranian military aircraft had been shot down by the South Yemen forces on the border between Zofar and South Yemen. And the aircraft had come down into the sea about 100 yards offshore. It was still visible, actually. Water was very shallow. And the Foreign Office had got information that the Iranian Navy had sent a task force there, and they were going to do a frogman operation to recover the aircraft. Well, the aircraft was not a particularly modern aircraft. There was no point, from the intelligence point of view, in recovering it. It was a standard American airplane of some kind. The war had ended insofar. There was apparently peace. And it was quite clear to the Foreign Office that if there was an Iranian military operation like this, it could reignite the whole war down there, and there was actually no purpose in it. So I was instructed to do whatever I could to prevent this from happening. Late in the afternoon, I thought of going to see the Shah. But then I thought that if I did and tried to persuade him to call this operation off, that he would just think this was cowardice, as it were, on the British part, and would get on his high horse and would take no notice. So I decided to go and see Asa Dalai Lama. I rang him up and went and called on him at his house, and he greeted me in a kind of black abba, looking absolutely like a skeleton and yellow in the face. And really, he'd been off duty for a long time. He didn't even know this incident had happened. He was completely out of touch with everything. I mean, he was just sitting in his house, effectively dying. I explained the whole thing to him. And I said, look, we're not giving this advice out of cowardice or anything of that kind, but simply because we think that if this happens, it's not going to gain Iran anything to get this broken up aeroplane back, and it could have a very disastrous effect on stability in that particular area. And can you do something? In fact, the prestige element of the thing was enhanced by the fact that the Iranian task force was under the command of Prince Shahyal. Well, Alan said, you know, I'll do what I can, go back to your embassy and I'll ring you in an hour's time. Well, he rang in an hour's time and said, it's okay, the whole thing's been called off. And they're on the way back to Bandarabad. Finish.
Wonderful.
Well, now, there's nobody else in the country who could have achieved that. I mean, this was a measure, as it were, even as a dying man, of his intimacy and, you know, his confidential relationship with the Shah. I think, as I said in the book, I think it was tragedy in a way for the Shah, in the kind of inevitability of history, perhaps, that Asa Dalai effectively died and actually died just at the time when the Shah needed advice from, you know, somebody who could give him advice when he needed it most. So because I don't think anybody else was in that position, certainly not Amir Abbas.
What about the coup?
I just don't know. I never did know, really. I never had any idea of the extent to which she actually discussed politics with him. I mean, her whole range of social affairs and character affairs and educational affairs and cultural affairs and all that kind of thing, yes, I think she had an enormous influence. But I just simply never knew, you know, how much she was part of the political act. I mean, some people said she was very involved, that she was in fact partly behind Rastakhiz. There was a lot of her kind of clever young men who thought it all up. I've heard that. But I've heard exactly the opposite, that they were not actually, they didn't, she and he, discuss these kind of political matters. I just don't know.
Because she's very intelligent, and also she's very politically aware.
Mm.
You see what I mean?
She's not,
she really has a very good political brain. I mean, she understands things very well when you talk to her. So maybe they had an arrangement whereby she would look after certain areas and wouldn't talk about anything else, or indeed she would be too busy to talk about anything else. But it seems to me that she was being as aware as she is politically and about what goes on. Things would inevitably be talked about. Indeed, she told me that they just talked quite freely with each other, without her advising or anything like that, but they would have intelligent conversations on equal terms. And I would have thought maybe one could get some, filter through something through her. I don't know.